And joining me by telephone on his way back from a conference is UL Civil Engineering Professor Dr. Chris Carroll. He is hurrying back to do some work on his Roman crane, which has been moved back to the UL campus. There will be a series of activities this Saturday as a part of Innovate Lafayette. UL is focusing on a number of its projects and research activities during eye-opening. And joining me in the KRVS studios is Brian Schubert. He is an assistant professor in the School of Geosciences here at UL Lafayette. His specialty is, well, I guess we'll talk a little bit more about that, Brian, but geochemistry, geobiology, a lot of interfacing, as you say, among the sciences these days. And you're here to talk about some of your research, in particular, some research that was just recently published in an internationally recognized magazine called Nature Communications. And maybe tell us just a bit about that magazine before we go into your research.
Yes, it's a very high-profile magazine that is published through the journal Nature, and they have an online journal that they've started recently called Nature Communications, and there's a subset of that Nature journal set.
So it's quite prestigious to have an article published in this magazine.
Yes, we were very excited by getting something into this. It has much more wide reach and because of its multidisciplinary nature.
Right. You published this paper with a colleague, Hope Jaron, who's at the University of Hawaii.
Correct.
You do work together.
Yes, she was my postdoctoral advisor while at the University of Hawaii.
All right. So from Hawaii to Louisiana.
Yes.
Well, I want to tell people that the title of your article is Reconciliation of Marine and Terrestrial Carbon Isotope Excursions Based on Changing Atmospheric CO2 Levels. I'm sure that makes people start to hyperventilate, thinking, how do I understand that? But of course, you're a professor, and you deal with students from freshmen all the way to graduate mm-hmm. students. And so, of course, you're able to help people with difficult concepts. Tell us about your research and how it brought you to this point with this paper.
A lot of the research I do is looking at how Earth's climate responds to changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. And towards this, we've done a lot of experiments just growing plants in the laboratory, looking at how they respond to changes in climate and changes in carbon dioxide levels. And we also study a lot of fossil plants and looking at periods of the rock record, of the geologic record, where plants have lived under very warm conditions or very high levels of carbon dioxide. A lot of the work we do is looking at fossil forests preserved in the Arctic during periods of very warm conditions when there were ice-free poles and there were alligators and palm trees north of the Arctic Circle. And that led towards this research where we're looking at specific intervals of the geologic record where we have extreme warming events and extreme changes in the global carbon cycle over a relatively short period of time.
So you're kind of like a historian of geology and biology and chemistry, looking back in history. And, you know, there are always people who say, well, why do we have to study history? Why do we have to know that? What difference does it make and what's going on now? Why is it so important to study what happened so far back?
This is our best analog for what the future will hold. A lot of the work that's done looking at interactions between climate and CO2 levels is based on models. And those models need some data to put into them. And they need to be able to sort of ground truth those models. And so as geologists, we can go back into the rock record and find intervals of Earth's history that have similar conditions and try to reconstruct what was going on at the time and what led to those types of changes. And then we use those models to test and see how well those models are actually recreating what we've actually seen happen in the past.
Mm-hmm. Because there have been instances in the past, different occurrences in biological forms where we've discovered a presence of something and there's a great excitement and shock about this. And eventually it's proved, well, that's what it was all along. You know, so that does happen. Mm-hmm. And you're always, as scientists, trying to understand what were, as you say, the ground truths about an organism or an organism in the past. So talk about your research, and again, I'm not sure people really understand what CO2 is an indicator of or what the problem with CO2 is. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So CO2, this is carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have changed throughout all of Earth's history. And throughout at least the last 500 plus million years, since there's been plants on the planet, it's been relatively well controlled and constrained within a reasonable range of CO2 levels that has allowed life to continue to thrive. We have no gaps in the record of life on the planet. And so we've never had events that have been so extreme that it's wiped out all life on the planet. But what we have seen is that these changes in the levels of carbon dioxide have had great effects on the conditions on the planet and have led to extinctions of certain species. And they've led to periods where we've had large-scale changes in the distribution of species on the planet and their abundance on the planet. Where they're located on the planet. And so during these periods of very warm conditions where we do have fossil evidence for forests above the Arctic Circle or forests in Antarctica where it's currently glaciated, we know that something was very different in the climate. And we can then see what was driving that. And throughout all of these intervals, we see that coincident with very warm temperatures are also very high levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we see this link. And one of the best periods showing this link are throughout the last about 65 million years. So it's been going on for a very long time that we see these connections between high levels of CO2 in the atmosphere and very warm temperatures. And so today we're actually in an ice house condition because we have ice at the poles. But prior to about 35 million years ago, we had ice-free conditions both in Antarctica and in the Arctic. And also at that time, we had very high levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so there's definitely a good link between the two, but we're trying to constrain how much of an effect that is.
Mm-hmm. So there might be some people hearing that who would go, oh, well, then it's just a natural occurrence. That's just something that happens naturally over time.
Yeah.
But your research is trying to understand rates of change, and is it as natural or acceptable as it has occurred in the past.
Yeah, that's a great point. The rate is one of the most important aspects of this, that we do have intervals of the rock record where we have very long periods of high CO2 and very long periods of low CO2 levels. But when we see very rapid scale changes like we're seeing today, these scale of changes, the rate of change is much greater than anything we have in the geologic record. And so we're basing our models on something where we have had It's relatively rapid compared to what we see in the geologic record. These events are fairly quick, what our research looks at. But they're still slow compared to what we're doing now.
You're talking about millions of years.
Yeah, these are on the timescales of millions of years. And these really what we consider geologically rapid is on the timescale of tens of thousands of years. So this is still much longer than what we're seeing today.
So talk about your research, which is attempting to show these rates of change. You're dealing with plants, and some people may not understand the difference between looking at levels of things in plants and minerals. What are you trying to understand in your work with plants?
So we're looking at these events called carbon isotope excursions, and these are basically geologic markers in the rock record that are both found in oceanic sediments and in terrestrial land sediments that record large-scale changes in the global carbon cycle. When we're looking at land sediments, these are mostly comprised that the materials we're measuring are basically dead plant material. We're looking at organic compounds that are from dead plants. In the marine realm, we're primarily looking at minerals that precipitated from the ocean water. We're looking at carbonate minerals for the most part.
As you mentioned, like little tiny creatures that had shells
that
died and fell.
Yes, these are a mixture of tiny microscopic shelled organisms and also just bulk marine carbonate that precipitates from the oceans. And so the marine carbonate that precipitates out is made up of calcium and carbonate, the carbon being in the carbonate. And that carbon is reflective of what the chemistry of the ocean was at the time. And the atmosphere and oceans are very well mixed on these kinds of timescales. And so what we saw, though, was that the signal that we are getting from the marine record, from the oceans, was showing a much smaller scale event than the signal we are getting from the terrestrial records. And this has been seen in hundreds of records all across the globe. And it's been measured for various multiple ones of these carbon isotope excursion events throughout the geologic record. The one that we looked at in particular was called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. And this is probably the most well-studied and well-known of these events. And it was one that occurred about 55 million years ago. during a period that was already very warm conditions, ice-free poles, forests above the Arctic Circle. And what we found was that we grew experiments under very controlled conditions, growing plants, and looked at how carbon was actually taken up by the plants under different levels of carbon dioxide. And we saw that was fundamentally different from how minerals are precipitating from the oceans. And we found that it was due to that offset we could actually explain the larger scale event that we saw on land versus the oceans. And so we used those two models, one the offset between the marine and the terrestrial record, and the other based on these experiments that we did in the lab under controlled conditions. And we saw that we could reconcile or explain the offset between the two very nicely solely due to the rise in CO2 levels that are experienced during these large-scale changes in the global carbon cycle.
And what does that help you explain, understanding that there is a difference in the way those two absorb and preserve indications of CO2?
The marine record being a smaller scale event would mean that the rise in temperatures we saw during this event, which has been reconstructed to be about 5 to 9 degrees Celsius on as a global average, so a very large scale rise in temperatures, would have been due to a much smaller amount of CO2 release into the atmosphere. Whereas if the terrestrial record was giving us the true record of the magnitude of this event, it means that a lot more carbon would have been released into the atmosphere to cause this 5 to 9 degree temperature rise. And so this means that when we're trying to look at how much CO2 is being added to the atmosphere today and how that will affect the temperatures, if the marine record was accurately showing what was going on, it would mean that a very small amount of CO2 rise can have a very large effect on temperature. Whereas if the terrestrial record was correct, it means that it would take a lot more of a CO2 rise in the atmosphere to cause the same amount of a temperature effect.
So you really need to look at the mineral record to understand accurately, whereas many people have perhaps been using the data from terrestrial plant-based CO2 levels.
Yes, you actually have to look at both. Mm-hmm. So they tell you different things. So the marine record is telling you the magnitude of the event. But by using both of them together, we can actually constrain what the actual CO2 levels were just prior to the event and at the height of the event. So with only prior to this work that we did comparing the two records, you could only tell that there was a change in CO2. You didn't know if CO2 levels rose from something like today, we're at 400 parts per million. If it rose to something like 400 parts per million to 1,400 parts per million, 1,000 ppm rise, or whether it was going from 1,400 parts per million to 2,400 parts per million, the same 1,000 ppm rise. And so by looking at both records, we actually can model what the actual CO2 levels were at the initial start of the event and at the height of the event.
And when you say event, again, you're not talking about something that happened in a day or a year.
Right. This is an event that the whole duration of the event is something like 100, 200,000 years. It rose very quickly on the timescale of maybe 10,000 years and then slowly decreased CO2 levels through time, just through feedbacks in the mm-hmm. carbon cycle.
Mm-hmm. And again, doing research to give an accurate sense of, I guess when we think, oh, that's such a long time, no problem, it's something that's natural, it just happened over time. But as we mentioned in the beginning of the interview, what you're really interested in by learning these accurate measurements is the rate.
That's right. That's
of
right.
Rise.
The rate of rise was very fast during these carbon isotope excursion events mm-hmm. in the fossil record. But they're still much slower than what we're seeing today. The rate of rise today, if we look at what we reconstructed CO2 levels to be based on our models, we found that the carbon dioxide levels background during this event were probably only about twice what they are today. But then they rose to about 2 to 3 times higher than that, which is much higher than what our estimates are for the next couple hundred years. So what we're dealing with today is a rapid rise that's more extreme than the most extreme event we can find in the geologic record.
Mm-hmm. And so your work has helped us understand those measurements and that rate of rise.
That's right.
If you're just tuning in, I want to let you know that my guest is UL Assistant Professor in the School of Geosciences, Brian Schubert. His background is in geochemistry, geobiology. Obviously, you can tell, works with many elements of the Earth. And his article, Reconciliation of Marine and Terrestrial Carbon Isotope Excursions Based on Changing Atmospheric CO2 Levels, was just published in Nature Communications, very prestigious online journal, which is a part of Nature. Everyone really knows that magazine. So very prestigious to have your article published in this magazine. Again, work you did with your colleague Hope Jaron from the University of Hawaii. Tell us just a moment about the School of Geosciences, and it's a very new school. I think it's just been here about a year, and so you've just been with us on the campus about a year. What is the school? Why was it formed, and what is the focus of your work there?
The School of Geosciences was formed last fall as a combination of the geology programs and the environmental sciences programs. And so we've moved into Hamilton Hall on campus, and we have new lab space and new office space there, which is very exciting. We're setting up new labs, and we're hiring new faculty. It's a very growing area on campus. And it's something that has really helped build on two strengths within the university of looking at a lot of interest in petroleum geology and building of fossil fuels, and also the environmental side of climate change as well. Mm-hmm. And so when I started in the program, I'm definitely at that interface with the environment and with studying fossil fuels. All of the dead organic plant material that I study that we're using for these measurements is also what's being, we're burning and at same type of thing, adding CO2 to the atmosphere.
Mm. Can you get a degree if you come as an undergraduate? Do you get a degree in geosciences? How do undergraduates come at this field of study?
So the undergraduate degrees are either in geology or in environmental sciences, but both are housed within the School of Geosciences. So you have resources from both. You can take classes across the board, but your degree would be a focus either in geology or in environmental sciences.
Mm-hmm. Do you have young biologists and chemists here? As you said, your background is in chemistry, biology. Do they interface with that program? Or is there a plan or a hope to incorporate more of that?
There's a lot of interest in adding more of that into the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Right now, you can be any science major and take these classes. We also have a lot of non-science majors that take the introductory geology classes. They're usually very engaging, very exciting, interesting type of classes that have fun labs. You learn a lot about the Earth and how the Earth works. And it's relevant to whether you're a biology, chemistry, or English major. To most anyone that's just living on this planet, it's nice to learn some of those basic processes.
Well, it sounds any young people interested in science, it sounds like a really fascinating field to go into. Now, the article that I have in my hands here, I had to have you translate for me. Again, published in Nature Communications. If anyone listening is interested in finding out more about the subject, probably just reading your article in Nature Communications might be bit difficult for lay people, scientists not so much. If they're interested in finding out more about the subject, where would you encourage them to go?
They're welcome to go look at the University of Louisiana Lafayette School of Geosciences webpage. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. On there we have great resources for access to the various faculty members in the department. Mm-hmm. And there's a link to my webpage there, which mm-hmm. also would have more information
about your study,
this particular mm-hmm. study, mm-hmm. and the general type of work that we're doing.
All right. And if somebody just wanted to read about the subject, was just curious, is there any like Nature magazine or, I mean, obviously Nature Communications is a bit more academic.
Sometimes they do general summaries of these types of articles. Mm-hmm. One it hasn't been written for this particular work, but it's something that there are general review articles on this whole broad area mm-hmm. that have been published in the last few years that are a little bit more accessible.
So you could go to Nature Communications and find
and
those
you would find
as well.
Links to those papers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, all right. Well, we'll look forward to one on yours as well. But we really appreciate you coming by and letting us know more about what you're doing, helping us to understand the importance of that research here on our campus.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brian Schubert, he is an assistant professor in the School of Geosciences here at UL Lafayette. His article was just published in a very prestigious magazine, academic magazine, Nature Communications. But as he mentioned, if you go there, you can find some general articles which are more understandable if you haven't had scientific training as well. Again, the title of that article, Reconciliation of Marine and Terrestrial Carbon Isotope Excursions Based on Changing Atmospheric CO2 levels. Well, thanks, Brian, and we're glad you're on our campus, and we look forward to talking with you in the future about your research.
Thank you very much.